We mentioned on an earlier program that in 1812, a group of rich Federalists that had been stockholders in the Bank of the United States applied for a charter for the Bank of America with a capital of $6 million, making it the largest bank in the United States at that time. Its first president was Oliver Wolcott, a former Secretary of the Treasury. On today's program, I want to give you a little history of the Bank of America since its incorporation by Amedeo Giannini. I do this because other than J.P. Morgan, who was merely an agent for the Rothschilds, Giannini was one of the few Gentiles that became head of a large national bank. Amedeo Giannini was raised by his mother and stepfather, Lorenzo Scatina, because his father had been fatally shot over a pay dispute with an employee. The history of the Bank of America dates back to 1904, when Giannini founded the Bank of Italy in San Francisco. The Bank of Italy served the needs of many immigrants settling in the United States at that time. This was a service denied to them by the existing American banks, who were typically discriminating and often denied service to all but the wealthiest. When the 1906 San Francisco earthquake struck, Giannini was able to save all deposits out of his bank building and away from the fires. Because San Francisco's banks were in smoldering ruins and the people were unable to open their vaults, Giannini was able to use the rescued funds to commence lending within a few days of the disaster. Over a makeshift desk, consisting of a few planks over two barrels, he lent money to those who wished to rebuild. Later in life, he took great pride in the fact that all of these loans were repaid. In 1922, Giannini established the Bank of America and Italy in Italy by buying Banca dell'Italia. This later bank was established in 1918 and 1919. In 1928, Giannini merged his bank with the Bank of America, Los Angeles, and consolidated it with his other bank holdings to create what would become the largest banking institution in the country. He renamed the Bank of Italy on November 3, 1930, calling it the Bank of America National Trust and Savings Association. The resulting company was headed by Giannini, with Ora E. Monette serving as co-chairman. Branch banking was introduced by Giannini shortly after 1909 legislation in California that allowed for branch banking in the state. Its first branch outside San Francisco was established in 1909 in San Jose. By 1929, the bank had 453 banking offices in California, with aggregate resources of over $1.4 billion. There is a replica of the 1909 Bank of Italy branch bank in History Park in San Jose, and the 1925 Bank of Italy building is an important downtown landmark. Giannini sought to build a national bank, expanding into most of the western states as well as into the insurance industry, under the aegis of his holding company, Transamerica Corporation. In 1953, regulators succeeded in forcing the separation of Transamerica Corporation and the Bank of America under the Clayton Antitrust Act. The passage of the Bank Holding Company Act of 1956 prohibited banks from owning non-banking subsidiaries such as insurance companies. Bank of America and Transamerica were separated, with the latter company continuing in the insurance business. However, federal banking regulators prohibited Bank of America's interstate banking activities, and Bank of America's domestic banks outside California were forced into a separate company that eventually became First Interstate Bank Corp, later acquired by Wells Fargo & Company in 1996. It was not until the 1980s, with the change in federal banking legislation and regulation, that Bank of America was again able to expand its domestic consumer banking activity outside California. new technologies were allowed credit cards to be linked directly to individuals' bank accounts. In 1958, the bank introduced the Bank AmeriCard, which changed its name to Visa in 1977. A consortium of other California banks introduced MasterCard to compete with Bank of America. Giannini had brought in two financial experts, Walker and Monet, who soon decided that the Transamerica company was overvalued and needed to be rescued. Giannini was persuaded to take a 2-year holiday to Austria, while Walker made himself president and Monet vice president. Before Giannini's 2-year exile was over, Walker became the largest stockholder in the Bank of Italy. Giannini was not about losing control of the bank, and after 2 years he came back ready for a fight. Many of the bank's stockholders were Italian farmers, and Giannini, at a stockholders' meeting, persuaded these stockholding farmers to vote Walker and Monet out and Giannini in. It worked, and Giannini became president of the Bank of America. That was the new name of the Bank of Italy. While he was in Europe, he became an admirer of Benito Mussolini. So many banks were insolvent during the 30s that Roosevelt pushed through Emergency Banking Act. This act allowed the Federal Reserve to give credit banks against assets which they could define in a very broad sense. This is the classic method of disguising a bank's insolvency. Not all banks were saved in this manner, and the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco stated that the Bank of America was hopelessly insolvent. Many of the bank's assets were mortgages on small farms, and Giannini argued that closing a bank with so many small depositors would result in negative political consequences. This, and the fact that Giannini had been a supporter of Roosevelt, got the White House to intervene and save the bank. Doc Giannini, the brother of the founder, financed Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and was Disney's bank from then on. He also financed the first $1 million loan for a movie of Sam Goldwyn. During the filming, Sam's wife was heard to comment, "Sam, you look so drawn." Doc Giannini replied, "What she means is overdrawn." Walter Houston's bank president in Frank Capra's 1932 film American Madness was based largely on Giannini. The Italian-American banker, played by Edward G. Robinson in House of Strangers in 1949, was also loosely based on Giannini. American Bankers magazine recognized him as one of the 5 most important influential bankers of the 20th century. In 2004, the Italian government honored Giannini with an exhibition and ceremony in its parliament to mark the centennial of his founding of the Bank of Italy. The exhibition was the result of the collaboration of the Ministry of Finance in Italy, the Smithsonian Institution, Italian Professor Guido Capozzano, and Peter F. De Nicola, an American collector of Giannini memorabilia. I hope you found the story of Giannini interesting. Now let's go back to the Second World War. I've taken a lot of this program from the book The Secret Empire by Cushman Cummins. You can order it on Amazon or contact me. It's a great book of history. Alfred Rosenberg, one of Hitler's top policy advisors, was invited to London in November 1931 and introduced to many leading British elite, including Montague Norman, the chairman of the Bank of England. Hitler was contacted by the British aristocracy, who encouraged him and his hatred of the Jewish Bolsheviks toward making war on the Soviet Union. Much of the encouragement came from the Prince of Wales, who would become King Edward VIII, and from Lord and Lady Astor, known as the Cliveden set. The Astors lived in an enormous estate called Clive that was named after Robert Clive, Clive of India, you may have heard of, who was related to the Astors. Franklin Delano Roosevelt sent Texas oil man William Rhodes Davis to Berlin, where Davis told Goring and Hitler that FDR sympathized with Germany and agreed that Danzig-Poland should be returned to Germany. Neville Chamberlain, Prime Minister of Britain, was seeing Hitler and asking for peace in our time. Hitler was convinced that the British government sympathized with him when he voiced his desire to reclaim the Polish corridor and other territories in the area that had been stolen from Germany through the Treaty of Versailles. He was greatly surprised after he invaded Danzig that the British declared war on Germany. He made offers of peace to Britain and even offered to demobilize the German army. He did demobilize 30 infantry divisions as evidence of his peaceful intentions. Lloyd George, Prime Minister of Britain during World War I, pleaded with Chamberlain to at least consider Hitler's offer. World War II, like all modern wars, was planned. At the same time, Roosevelt was telling the American public that he would not send their boys abroad. He was telling the military brass to plan for an invasion of Europe using millions of men. We have been educated to believe that we were unaware of the possibility of a Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that occurred on December 7, 1941. I live in a small community of Punta Gorda, Florida. We have a small military museum in our town. In that museum, we have the front page of the Honolulu newspaper dated November 30, 1941. The headline reads something to the effect of Pearl Harbor expecting a Japanese attack, possibly by next weekend. How did the paper get there? It was because a sailor was in the hospital that day as a patient. He was reading the newspaper when he heard that the United States Army was ripping the front off every newspaper it came into contact with. The sailor tore off the front page, folded it up, and stuck it under his pillow. When the Army authorities got to his room, he told them that someone else had already torn the front page off his paper. Then he sent the paper to his mother. Years later, after his mother had died, he was going through her belongings and came across the paper, which he later donated to this museum. It is probably the only copy of the front page of the Honolulu newspaper dated November 30th, 1941. I repeat, the war was planned. Before the war got started, Eisenhower went from a lieutenant colonel to major general in just a few months, although he having a mediocre record and poor comments by former superiors. General George C. Marshall was promoted ahead of many other better-rated generals, although earlier he had failed in various field commands and was going to retire early. Then there was General William B. Beadle Smith, who had not even been an officer in the regular U.S. Army before World War II. He came out of nowhere and was appointed the Supreme Allied Commander's right-hand man. He did have an unexplained rapport with top British political elites, such as Lord Halleck and Harold Macmillan, who later became British Prime Minister. After the war got going good, Hitler claimed he had an impregnable west wall located in Dieppe, France, that would prevent the British and their allies from attacking Germany through France. The British had sent two Canadian regiments there and then abandoned them. They were soundly defeated. Churchill used this as an excuse to attack Germany through North Africa and the soft underbelly of Europe. Later, after General Erwin Rommel was removed from command of the African Corps and put in command of the West Wall, Rommel stated in his diary that he was horrified to discover that there was no West Wall. General Patton was dismayed to discover that the French army that had 700,000 in personnel that was left out of his plans for invading Europe, and that the Allies intended to break their promise to the French to invade southern France, and instead of invading the broad open plains of southern France, were going to go up the mountainous Italian peninsula, which the Germans could easily defend with a few divisions. After D-Day, Patton's Third Army charged across Normandy, France, and into Metz. There, two German army colonels came to see him carrying a white flag. They told Patton that they had been sent by the generals in charge of the Middle Rhine area. They offered him a bridge so that he could run his Third Army into Berlin, which would surrender to him before the Red Army got there. Being the good soldier that he was, Patton radioed London to appraise them that he was taking his army across the Rhine and was heading for Berlin. He asked that all U.S. Army units in France be routed to Metz and follow the Third Army across the Rhine. He also wanted a regiment of paratroopers to be dropped on the other side of the river in order to protect the bridgehead from any Nazis that might try to attack it and stop the Americans from crossing. At first, the request was affirmed, but in a matter of hours, orders came down from Eisenhower's headquarters not to cross the Rhine. All units in France were ordered to stay where they were and not move east. All supply depots in Cherbourg were ordered not to issue one more round of ammunition or one more gallon of gas to anyone until further notice. Even the Red Ball Express, the truck convoy which carried fuel, ammo, and supplies from Cherbourg to the army in a continuous column of trucks, was ordered to stop. Of course, Patton raised holy heck fire, but he was stopped. He could not advance one more foot. Just days afterwards, the German generals in charge of the Middle Rhine were relieved of command, and more German troops were put in place to guard the bridge. Why was Patton ordered to stop his advancement? The war was scheduled to last a certain period of time, and it lasted exactly 6 years. Was that accidental? Doesn't the devil's number have something to do with six? We have talked before about the money that can be made by some corporations during a war. Let me give you a couple of examples of war's money makers. Rolls-Royce, the elite automobile manufacturer in England. Their cars are so expensive that only a fraction of the upper 1% of the population can afford them, and one of their cars lasts for years. Our United States German tanks had Rolls-Royce engines in them. What the people couldn't afford, the government could, and they could tax the people to pay the interest on the money the government borrowed to buy the Rolls-Royce engines. The same is true of many of the Allied airplanes used in World War II. They also had Rolls-Royce engines in them. Think about how many tanks and planes were destroyed in the war and had to be replaced. Coca-Cola said that our soldiers would always have easy access to Cokes in the countries in which they were fighting. War for Coca-Cola was a great marketing tool. After the war, most of the fighting men came home, but the demand for Cokes stayed in the countries where the troops had been. The U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, proposed a plan for deindustrializing Germany after the war and making it an agricultural nation. You see, Theodor Kaufmann had written a book in 1941 called Germany Must Perish. In this writing, he described a plan for the total destruction of the German population by the mass sterilization of all German men, women, and children between the age of puberty and 60 years of age. This book was the basis for the Morgenthau Plan, which called for the total destruction of German industry and the enslavement of the German people.
Doesn't this make Winston Churchill's statement more understandable when he said, "You must understand that this war is not against Hitler or National Socialism, but against the strength of the German people, which is to be smashed once and for all, regardless of whether it is in the hands of Hitler or a Jesuit priest."
The plan to so completely annihilate the German population through starvation was also discussed. When Hitler heard of the Morgenthau plan to turn Germany into an agricultural state, Hitler became furious and ordered a grand offensive against American armies in the West. He set the date for the attack in early December. Shortly after the plan was laid out, the Swiss intercepted a radio message from a Soviet agent in Berlin to a Soviet spy in Bern, codename Lucy. This intercepted message gave complete details about the planned offensive in the West. Swiss intelligence gave the message to the chief of U.S. intelligence in Bern. His name was Alan Dulles. When the Wehrmacht offensive in the Ardennes broke out in December, the American army was surprised and thrown back in confusion with heavy losses. Why were the leaders of the American armies not advised of Hitler's plans? What happened to the intercepted message, later referred to as the Lucy message? No one knows. This was a major battle in the Second World War and was called the Battle of the Bulge. While it was being fought, the Red Army was rolling toward Berlin, plundering, raping, and devastating everything in their path.
When Eisenhower became president, he nominated Alan Dulles as head of the CIA and his brother, John Foster Dulles, as Secretary of State. Senator Albert Gore Sr. was a close friend of Cordell Hull from boyhood. Cordell Hull was Secretary of State under FDR, and Senator Gore's principal financial and political supporter was Armand Hammer, owner of Occidental Petroleum, and he also had top-level influence within the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Senator Gore was put in charge of a secret Senate subcommittee for development of the atomic bomb that financed the Manhattan Project. He, FDR, Henry Hopkins, and Armand Hammer arranged for dozens of plane loads of atomic technology, U-235 uranium ore, to be flown to the USSR from a secret U.S. airbase in Montana named Albert Gore Field. Henry Dexter White sent 5 plane loads of money plates, paper, and ink to Russia for the printing of our currency in Russia, which must be redeemed by the U.S. It is not the responsibility of the FRS to secure the plates. When asked the Treasury Department to advise the whereabouts of same, they replied that they did not know. Hitler's Third Reich never once ordered the destruction of any book. The famous book burnings were not government-directed at all. They were quite entirely symbolic and quite limited in number, and they were carried out by university professors, students, and intellectuals who were not among the strongest supporters of the new Hitler regime. No libraries were raided. No bookstores were sacked by jackboot thugs. There were 4,175 titles officially banned by the Reich at one point or another over a 12-year period, but were preserved in government archives. Under American occupation, however, there were 36,645 individual titles, plus every school textbook used in Germany from 1933 to 1945, which were officially banned by the U.S. Military Occupation Office of Information Control. Since the Americans did not want to be accused of burning books just like the Nazis, libraries, bookstores, and publishing warehouses were raided and tons of books were pulped. General Robert McClure was in charge of the book pulping. He left the day-to-day decisions as to which book to pulp to his deputy chief, who was a Russian-born Jew named William Paley, who was also a high-ranking Freemason and founder of the CBS broadcasting empire. He had the title Colonel, despite no real record of military service. Paley took time off from his media dynasty to direct the destruction of German literature and the arts. An OIC study by California State University's Dr. Cora Goldstein in the March-April 2008 issue of Military Affairs reported that the OIC's policies reflected the ideological profile of its staff and that a significant portion of the staff were New Dealers, intellectuals, immigrants, Jews, and leftists. These were the creatures that were paid by the American tax dollar who conducted, unquestionably, the greatest campaign of book burning in all recorded history. The CFR also created the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944, which gave birth to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. The final act of Bretton Woods, which gave birth to the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, and many similar assemblies of hand-picked functionaries, were not incubated by hard-pressed governments engaged in waging war, but by a supranational money power which could afford to look ahead to the shaping of a post-war world that would serve its interest. The Bretton Woods Agreement of 1944 made the dollar the preeminent world reserve currency, replacing the British pound. This agreement was made because the U.S. had a huge amount of gold defined as 1/35th of an ounce of gold and because of its political and military muscle. The dollar was convertible to all foreign central banks at that rate, but for American citizens, it remained illegal to own. During World War II, 38.8% of the servicemen and servicewomen in the United States military were volunteers. Of all the people examined for induction, 35.8% were rejected as physically or mentally unfit. The average time spent in service was 33 months. 73% of those inducted spent 16 months overseas. Of one out of every 1,000 soldiers, 86 were killed in action, 3 died from other causes, and 177 were wounded. The estimated international cost of World War II in battle deaths was $14,904,000 and 25,218,000 wounded. Civilian deaths totaled 38,573,000. The United States cost of the war totaled $1.6 trillion. U.S. Armed Forces killed and wounded from 1939 to 1945 totaled 234,874 killed and 565,861 wounded. The Navy had 36,950 killed and 37,778 wounded. Marines had 19,711 killed and 67,207 wounded. The Coast Guard had 575 killed and 432 wounded. Merchant Marines had 37 killed and 5,662 missing at sea. We'll continue with the end of World War II and the post-war period on our next show. Until then, thanks for listening and question everything you hear and see. Until then, auf Wiedersehen.